Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 23rd of August, 2013, here in Japan. And today I'm joined on the line from the United States by our old friend John Rappaport, who you might remember from his previous appearances on this program. So if you do not remember that, I suggest you look in the archives for those previous appearances. Of course, you can find him at his blog, johnrappaport.wordpress.com. And there you can find details about his other work, including Exit from the Matrix and other work like that. So let's bring him up. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be here, James. Thanks.
Excellent. Well, it's good to talk to you again, to talk to you about your work at nomorefakenews.com and your blog at johnrappaport.wordpress.com. And of course, that will be linked up in the show notes. But today we're going to be talking about something a little bit different from the news and politics that we're often talking about here on this show, or are we? And that's going to be the topic of art, which I know is one that's near and dear to your heart, as to mine and a lot of people out there. And I know that you yourself are an artist, and of course, not just in the sense that your writing is an art form, which of course it is, and a labor of love and craft, I'm sure, but also that you're a visual artist. Tell us a little bit about that side of your creativity.
Well, I started painting in 1962 based upon no previous indication of any talent whatsoever. In fact, in elementary school, the teacher suggested to my mother that I be removed from the art class because I had no talent and I was falling behind. So I just happened to be living in New York in 1962, fresh out of college, and I saw some paintings in a painter's studio, and I said, I just have to do this. Doesn't matter if I'm any good or not. And my life just absolutely changed within a period of a couple of months. Things happened to me that were really extraordinary, one of which was I repaired my relationship with my family, which had been in rather dire straits. And there was no particular connection that I could make, except reality looked completely different to me once I began painting. And so I've continued all these years, and it means a great deal to me because I see it as a way of establishing another beachhead of reality that is completely different from consensus reality, which I think is a very healthy thing. And I wish that we had more children in schools doing that. Unfortunately, at least in America, funding for art programs in schools has been very much on the downside because they consider if you're not studying math or science that you're really not a useful citizen.
Well, I'd prefer if children weren't locked into the cages of public schooling for most of their childhood anyway, but point well taken. And I understand you've also had your artwork displayed in galleries in New York and in Los Angeles, and it had your poetry featured in the Massachusetts Review.
Yes, that's right. In fact, I just finished a long poem, which I haven't published yet, that I've been working on for about 5 or 6 years. So that continues to be part and parcel of everything that I'm doing, including the reporting that I do.
Well, that is fascinating, and it's very interesting to know about that, because, of course, I'm sure most of the people who are listening in my audience probably associate you with your more political articles, but I think this is absolutely an essential part of understanding the world around us, although I'm not sure. I think there are points of agreement and disagreement between us on this point. And let's bring some of your writings into this. Let's talk about one of your recent blog posts called Why People Fear Art. This was posted to your website on August 10th, 2013. And again, I will put the link in the show notes for people. But it's an interesting take on art and art's position in reality. Why don't you tell people a little bit about what art and its position in the world is, in your estimation?
Well, from everything that I've been able to discern from living on this planet for the last 75 years, people have an addiction to pattern. They want everything to have structure, system, pattern, which is fine. I mean, these things are very useful, but there's a sort of obsession about it, in a way. And I've noticed that when people who have sort of reached the end of the line on that, and I've worked with some of these people, some have been friends, you know, their lives just seem to kind of dead end eventually, and they feel that they have been too obsessed with pattern, with the way things are structured, that it gets to be repetitious and boring and the same over and over again. And I've introduced him to the idea of just beginning to paint, for example. And I've seen in some cases remarkable changes that come over people, because the thing about painting is, and the other arts as well, if you start out with no preconceptions, then everything that you hold dear to yourself, all your beliefs and ideas and patterns and so forth, are no longer necessarily going to guide you through. You're going to have to do something else now. This is not, you know, the same old kind of activity. You've got a blank sheet of paper or canvas in front of you. You've got paints and a brush. And you're going to embark on an adventure that has no particular shape. It's all going to be creative, imaginative, coming from you. And when that happens, I think that people enter into another kind of consciousness universe, and that this opens the way to them for a different kind of consciousness than they've ever experienced before, and one that's extremely healthy.
I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I think that's a good summarization of the creative process. But there's a point at which I start. Well, for example, the idea that people are obsessed with pattern, and when they see something that doesn't quite fit that mold, for example, surrealistic art, it blows their mind and they can't handle it. I understand that. I agree with that. I think that there is still people who are very literalist, very reality based in that sense, and I think that is to their detriment. And so I agree with that. But at the same time, I think that there is a creative process in finding and establishing and connecting pattern within works of art themselves. And I think that might be an interesting avenue of exploration of what it means to be creative, because I think creation is not simply the creation of paintings or poetry or the like. I mean, we're all creating thoughts and manifesting those in the world every day. And I think that is no less a creative process than the creative process that's engaged in by the artist himself. So that, for example, one of the recurring podcast series that I do is called Film Literature in the New World Order, where every month we dissect a different book or movie and look for the pattern and the way that connects into the reality as we're living it today, so that we can understand the world a little bit better through the art. And whether it's looking at something like Lord of the Rings or Enemy of the State or whatever it may be, we've looked at numerous different ways in which these works of art can be understood through the lens of what's happening in the world around us. And I think of that as a type of creative process in and of itself, the identifying and the understanding of the pattern within the art. Even if it wasn't intended by the author, it's still perfectly valid, I think, for the reader, the person taking in that art, to do that. I'm throwing a lot there on the table. Why don't we pick up from whatever threads of that that you want to pick up from?
I agree absolutely with you. I have no problem with that at all. In fact, I really agree that you could take five very intelligent people and show them the same movie and ask them what patterns they see in it and how they relate to what's going on in the world, and you could get five very different and interesting answers, and they would all be creative answers. Absolutely. In fact, I think that's one thing that artists do. The famous literary critic Harold Bloom has a thesis that, in fact, the way poets who are on the edge of discovery of what their own work is going to be, the way they function is by reading past poets and, as he puts it, misreading them completely, because they're looking at it from their own subjective point of view. And in that misreading, they are inspired to begin to write what they write on their own. So they're seeing pattern from a subjective point of view, and that kind of vaults them up onto another creative level. So I absolutely agree with that. At the same time, I would like to see more people who do analysis of art become artists. I would like to see them actually pick up the brush or begin to write a poem or a short story or a play or a screenplay or musical composition, because I think it would help them significantly to understand what other artists are doing once they begin to do it on their own.
I agree with that, although I have the secret suspicion that almost every critic out there is probably a failed artist in of their own right. So I'm sure that's probably more common than we give them credit for. But well, let's hone in on this then. So, for example, you also have a different post that was written even more recently called "Why Must Art Imitate Reality?" in which you even more strongly talk about the way that we're conditioned to believe that art must in some way intersect with the real world. And you talk, for example, about the idea of writing a play in which Edward Snowden is a dictator in a police state, and the NSA are revolutionaries battling for freedom, and other such ideas, which people might be taken aback by. They might actually be offended by that. Oh, well, you're tarnishing Edward Snowden. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of that piece and what you were trying to convey there?
Well, I was trying to convey that there is a tyranny of reality that affects many people. They feel that what is here in this world is, quote, the way it is, and it really can't be changed. And so when they look at art, they expect it, or they even want it, to mirror something in reality so that they can point at it and say, well, that's that. You see, that is just like that. That's a perfectly rendered apple, which I could almost eat. And I know that because I know apples, to put it very simplistically. And when you begin to see art or encounter art that diverges from that, people tend to get nervous because they are glued to reality. And what part of what art is doing is trying to take them away from that and say, here's another reality, look at this. And in fact, in the case of this idea about a play in which Snowden is the NSA and the NSA is Snowden, the fictional aspect of that, the ridiculous reversal, could wake people up to the reality of what's happening in the world even more than daily news reports on what's going on, because it's a jarring sensation. All of a sudden, they're looking at something that is completely absurd, and they wake up to the absurdity of what's happening in the world. So that was part of what I was trying to get at in that piece.
Well, then maybe I'm misreading the piece in some way, but it seems to me that the value of the art derives not from the mere act of creation, not merely from that, but from the intersection of the art and the consciousness of the artist with the actual real world. And in that example specifically, for example, part of the value derives from that jarring reaction that we have from seeing the exact inversion of what we take reality to be. So I certainly agree that art doesn't have to imitate reality. It doesn't have to have anything to do with reality. Being a fan of modernist literature, I look to people like James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake, that is not a work that has anything to do with reality as we know it, and yet it's still profoundly fascinating and frustrating and beautiful and jarring and incomprehensible, and I revel in all the different aspects of a work like that. But what then do we make of specifically consciously political art? So whether it's Solzhenitsyn writing about the gulags, or John Lennon with his propaganda for peace, or whatever different aspects of that we might look at, what about the artists who are specifically trying to affect the world through their art? Is that dumbing the art down, or is that bringing it down to a lower level?
It could be, but it depends on the artist. I mean, 1984, Orwell's novel, is certainly not dumbing down anything. I mean, I think, you know, people now reading it might say, well, this is kind of obvious. We have the hero and we have the oppressive state and we have all of these techniques that the state uses to destroy the individual and so forth and so on. But at the time that Orwell was writing it, I think that he was launched into an imaginative exploration of a world that he could create side by side with this one. And it wasn't so much that he was just inferring the exaggeration of certain things that were going on in the world politically. That's true. But he was saying, okay, I see what's in front of me here politically in the world. Now, let me write about it from the point of view of, if you want to call it science fiction or futurism, I don't want to just infer and refer. I want something that'll stand on its own as a world. I'm going to make a world. And that's what he did. And absolutely, he expected it to be read so that the reader would make intersections, as you say, between what he's doing and the real world, which I applaud. I think it's fantastic. But I think where people sometimes don't quite see what's happening there is that the artist really does make a separate world. Here it is. And it has specific relationships to what is happening now. But I'm not just extrapolating. I'm not just writing an editorial. I'm giving life to this thing. And by giving life to it, you, the reader, find the life in it. You feel that life, and that's why it becomes potent. If I didn't do that, you would just say, well, this is sort of an interesting essay. It's kind of clumsy, and sure, I get the point, but who cares? The artist breathes life into something where there was no life before. And then you make the comparisons between what he did and the world as it exists, and it becomes even more powerful.
I certainly understand that. And Orwell is specifically a very interesting example to look at, not only for 1984, but for Animal Farm, which itself is a very a formulaic allegory. I mean, every character in that, every event that happens in that can very easily be transposed into the history of the development of Soviet Union. I mean, it's art that's very much consciously basing itself on reality.
Yes, I think it is. But yet I say based on and creating something that stands on its own are two different things. The reader can make the connection, but what Orwell did was to create each creature as something that is animated and alive. That's what an artist does. And then we have other kinds of artists who are, you know, respected, hated, reviled, et cetera, et cetera. Like, take, for example, two great examples in the 20th century, Henry Miller and Ayn Rand. Couldn't be further apart, apparently. But yet, at the same time, there is a sort of reckless construction of a completely alien sort of life in these novels that shocks people and makes them look at their own lives to either affirm what that life is or to realize that their own lives are dead ends and they need to do something completely different. And they do, especially, I would say, in some of the novels of Henry Miller, he does such an excellent job at it that you feel that he's just simply taking a notebook around with him every day and writing down what's happening to him, when that obviously is not the case. You feel that you're there on the street with him and you're starving, and at the same time you couldn't be happier because you're liberated from the system. I think a lot of great art is about that. It's about liberation from the system. And when people feel that and see that, that shocks them into wanting the same thing because they've always really wanted that and they don't know how they got embroiled in the system and they want out. To me, that's one of the keys of 20th century art.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me, and it speaks to a lot of the art that really resonates with me. I know it's not particularly avant-garde to say this, but Picasso, for example, that his artwork really speaks to me in a way, and I think that is because it is liberating from the way that we've been trained to see the world, and it can be extremely jarring, but extremely satisfying to have that experience of seeing things from multiple perspectives at the same time. And things like that really do appeal to me. So I very much understand what you're saying there. But perhaps then the real dichotomy isn't between art and reality, because that can have a multitude of different manifestations. It can be art based on reality. It can be art subverting reality. It can be art completely detached from reality. To me, I think the real important dichotomy is between the art and the audience, and the way that the artist is able to create an impression or a sense within the audience or fails to do so might be the real standard by which we can measure the art.
Yeah, that's certainly important, no question about it. It's just different artists, I would say, go about that in different ways. For some artists, it's completely denying the audience that gives them their power over the audience. Because they say, here's my life, or here is a life, I'm going to show it to you. It's a kind of a life that doesn't care about conformist consensus reality at all. And therefore, I don't really care about you in a way. Sort of a covert assumption. And then here's the work. And the audience goes, wow, I'm connecting with this, because deep within me is this same reckless desire to get out of the system that I've been in for so many years. So I think each artist in that way is different. For example, Cézanne was able to make paintings that some of which were so beautiful that the audience would never stop to think about how he built them, on what forms, what basic volumes and so forth he fleshed out to make these marvelous landscapes. And the connection was immediate. Other artists like Picasso, there was a period of time during which, you know, people just were unwilling or unable to catch on to what he was doing at all. And then finally they began to see, well, here's a guy who is showing me other worlds that don't, you know, yes, I see it's not completely different, but it's so different from what I see around me every day that when I come back from a tour of Picasso, and I experienced this as a painter when I first started painting, the world as I see it now in front of me is different. The exercise of imagination of the individual and the expression of that imagination, when he comes back to this world, he now does not see it in the same way anymore. And that, to me, is quite fantastic, to be able to do that.
It certainly is, and I think it's an underappreciated part of our existence as human beings. When we look back at history, when we think of the defining events of history, we always think of them in terms of the specific names and dates and places that have certain specific events happened and history unfolded in a certain manner. I think something that's hardly, if ever, appreciated is the way that people's understanding of reality and ability to react to what's happening to them in their reality and their ability to shape the reality around them is itself shaped by the art that has informed their consciousness. And that's a very abstract idea, so I understand why it's not something that most historians will confront. But it would be interesting, I think, to see a history of the world as told through it, the arts coming to shape people's understanding of the world around them and the development of that throughout history. I think that would be a fascinating thing to explore.
You bet. Walt Whitman's effect on America. I mean, here was a giant, right, who could embrace all of life as he saw it around him, and did, in long, rambling poems that went on forever. And yet, because people were more literate at the time, they were able to read and understand and appreciate these poems and feel that America at that period of time was somehow more enhanced, more of, if you will, even an enchanted place than it actually was, because they were seeing it through Whitman's eyes. The open road, the possibility of experience, endless experience in life, and the unknown and the unpredictable and the adventurous. One of the things that he expressed so fantastically well. And the whole country, in a way, was mesmerized by this guy. And the effect on the country, I think, as you say, by historians, has never really been calculated or estimated. So that would be a fantastic kind of endeavor to do.
Absolutely. In fact, the idea is just really occurring to me through the course of this conversation. But if I was a young, budding university student again, I would probably be concentrating on this. I think it is a fascinating thing to think about. Well, today on the podcast, we're talking about politics, political art, how art informs politics, how artists can confront the political situation we're dealing with. In that regard, what artists do you think are either out there today, or artists that from the past that have had that effect of really helping to shape the political landscape?
Well, the anti-political landscape. I mean, the landscape of those who are rebelling against the overwhelming political system that we are living in, Philip K. Dick has to rank right up there, and wasn't really discovered to a significant degree until after he died, because movies started to be made of his novels and short stories and so forth. But he was the kind of guy who said to me, the overwhelming question is, what is reality? That was what he based his books upon, his science fiction novels. And woke up a significant sector of the country of people who were aware and had themselves been beginning to think about that question. What is it anyway? What is reality on any level? Political, cultural, social, propaganda, media. And you find all of that in his books. And you find that the people who are supposed to be, you know, the pillars of the community and so forth are all completely corrupt. And that they are sort of henchmen or agents for some kind of hideous reality that is like some fungus that has taken over the world, you know. And then you have the hero who is trying to figure this out and break out of it. Well, that's become a paradigm, I think, for many researchers, independent investigators, reporters who are alternative reporters, artists themselves. So he's one of the giants to me. There are others, but I would certainly, William Burroughs is another one, but Philip K. Dick to me stands out there very high up.
Well, that's an interesting choice, and one that I completely agree with. I certainly see how it meshes with your aesthetic philosophy, because Philip K. Dick is someone who is clearly creating these incredible imaginative worlds that are very, one really has to immerse oneself in that world to even begin to understand what's happening. And yet, despite the very imaginative, very, very disconnected world that he was living in, even in his own biography, I mean, he believed that the world that he was creating was intersecting with his own life. And he had a very, very interesting biography that I think people should be looking into. And in fact, I might explore in more detail in the future, because as you say, his books turned out to be very prescient in certain ways, and has definitely started to impact more and more of the culture as it gets disseminated further and further through Hollywood and the Hollywood predictive programming machine, which is another aspect of all of this.
Yeah, perhaps, right. One
we should touch on in a conversation like this, because of course, art is such an incredibly powerful and an incredibly potentially liberating tool for humanity, but it's also one that can be wielded by the propagandists to keep us locked into that reality that they want to paint for us. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about that.
Well, Philip Dick was certainly aware of that, and he made that fairly clear, these propaganda universes, you might say, that are being just loaded into the mind of the public. But yes, the avalanche of science fiction movies in Hollywood that all involve gigantic invasions from other realms, you know, of monsters, machine-like monsters in many cases, or insectoid-type monsters that, you know, how do we ever defeat them, and so on and so forth. Now, some people think this is predictive programming in the sense that it's setting the stage for an actual alien invasion from outer space. Maybe. I think the way I plug into this is it's predictive in the sense that it is conditioning the public to believe that the future is going to be locked down completely tight, that there is no fighting against such a force. I mean, you could defeat it temporarily here and there, but, you know, the takeover is going to happen regardless, and there's no use fighting at all. You can do is find your niche in it. It's not so much the power of any one of these movies, but it's just the cumulative on and on and on of one invasion movie after another that kind of settles people into this frame of mind, which I think is, you know, effective propaganda. And it's a form of art, to be sure.
Well, certainly dystopian fiction is much more common than its opposite, and we are constantly presented with examples of worlds in which people are locked down and told what to do and oppressed in various ways, and it's always some sort of narrative about someone fighting back against that system and the like. But you're right. The overwhelming impression is that the future will almost inevitably be this type of lockdown system of complete control. And it really does start to manifest in reality in various ways that some of them perhaps may be coincidental, others are not. And when you look at something like a Minority Report, people have seen over the last several years story after story after story after story in the news media saying, well, you know that thing they showed you in Minority Report? Well, now it's a reality.
All right. And
specifically in that case, it's interesting to look at because Spielberg, in the creation of that movie, convened a little mini conference, including some of the cutting-edge researchers in engineering and architecture and the like, to come together to actually create what they called the Bible of the future 2042 or whatever year it's supposed to be. And they created this document that was supposed to be their best guesses of exactly what the world will look like in the next 30 or 40 years. And lo and behold, all these technologies that they were writing about are suddenly coming into reality. So they're creating the world that they want for their corporate masters, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, this is the stuff I don't like. This kind of like working the way Spielberg did here. Because this is obviously imagination in the service of something else. The difference between seeing that movie, Minority Report, and I mean, there were good pieces in it and so forth, but, and reading the raw words of, say, Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, of Philip Dick, that novel, is the difference between feeling like you've got your hands on a live wire of electric life force, you know, which is waking up to bigger consciousness, and looking down some sort of tunnel that is narrowing into the way things are going to be. To me, that is the difference between night and day. It just isn't even close. And for those artists who try to do that, okay, let's put people in a tunnel, you see. This is what we want to do to the audience. And then we narrow it down and we just invoke more and more fear. And then, yeah, the hero sort of wins at the end, but we leave them with this impression. Spielberg has always loved to frighten people in his movies. You know, he just gets off on that. Jaws, you know, and that sort of thing. Poltergeist, all that, you know. Let's just scare the hell out of everybody, you know, and really, that's just horrific as far as I'm concerned. The idea is to open it all up and to show that freedom and the individual really are powerful. It's not just, oh, one guy just managed to crawl out of the, you know, crater and we'll see what happens. No. No, that's not the way it goes. The reason that there's so much propaganda in this world, the reason is because it's necessary. And the reason it's necessary is that because within the individual, there is this tremendous energy about freedom. And if there weren't, you could take three PR guys out of Washington and just say, okay, we'll give you 6 weeks to hypnotize the whole country and it'll all be over. It just doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. And this is something that I think has been understood since the earliest time of civilization. And this is why the drama was so important to the Greeks, for example, and shaped their society. And I think for the last couple of thousand years, they've been refining the various techniques by which they can use that art to lull people into various stupors. And every now and again, you do come across the artists who truly break through that. And in the cinematic medium specifically, the person that I look to in that regard is Stanley Kubrick. And his work has had, I think, more of that type of effect on me than any other film director, by far. The type of consciousness expanding ability of his work to truly transport people to a different mode of perception. But at the same time, I'm sensitive to the insinuations that he was working for a Masonic agenda and what that greater agenda might have been. So it can be a morass of trying to pick through the agendas that might be behind this, even at the time you're having a transcendent experience of imbibing something like 2001.
I think the transcendence is much more important to me. And I would choose of the films 2001 as being, you know, maybe his greatest example. Paths of Glory, also a fantastic movie. But in 2001, to me, he's saying, look what happens to your mind if we go into outer space and we slow things down. Just be aware of what happens to you in the theater. I'm going to give you images here that are great. Don't worry about that. We've got our guy on board. He knows how to do this. And we're going to show you outer space and the ships and the rooms and the time passing and the rhythm of consciousness in that realm. And something's going to happen to you. You're not going to walk out of the theater with exactly the same sense of time or space. And this is the primary, to me, delivery system and the message of that movie, regardless of what, you know, symbols are involved and so on and so forth. I think that his work transcends all of that. Barry Lyndon, same thing. In some respects, a kind of a boring movie, and I think he's supposedly cut out some scenes that might have been important. I don't know why. Ryan O'Neill thought that, you know, he was going to become a star after that movie, and he was very upset that he thought some of his key scenes were cut out of the movie. But that is just one magnificent painting after another, that movie. And if you just turned off the sound and just looked at the pictures, you would be transported to another kind of consciousness where beauty becomes the fact. Beauty becomes the status quo. And then when you return to this life and you see many things that are not beautiful, maybe it influences you in the direction of wanting to do something about that, as opposed to just saying, well, this is the way it is, and that's it.
And where did Kubrick get that lens that he was able to film Barry Lyndon all in natural light from?
I don't know. Do you know?
NASA, actually. So
oh,
that's
really?
An interesting little connection that,
okay.
that feeds into some of the theories about
yeah,
Kubrick.
Yeah,
so I'll
yeah.
leave it there. I think I did mention that in my podcast about Kubrick. So
I see.
Yeah. Just an interesting little tidbit. All right. I think we'll leave things at that point. Just so much more that we could be talking about, but I hope this at least introduces the idea to the audience here. Obviously, we're concentrating on political art in the context of today, more so in today's podcast episode, but I think our conversation expands that out significantly and shows what's at least possible in the realm of art. So why don't we direct people to your website again so that they can find some more of your writings about this?
Sure. NoMoreFakeNews.com. They'll find everything there, including links into my blog, and they can sign up for free emails and so forth. So that's all I have to do.
Excellent. All right, John, thank you for a fascinating conversation. It was very interesting for me.
Me too. Thanks, James. I appreciate it.